Mostly, she hates that she felt compelled to show up. When the heavy temple doors close behind her, cutting off the sounds of the city and trapping her along with the breeze, she nearly bolts. She should not have come. Luca should have come to them. She should have come to Westwood House on her knees after what she did to Mirabella. Instead, she appointed Bree to the Black Council, along with herself and her pet monster Ro, of course, and wrote that Bree should join her for tea at the temple before appearing at the Volroy. "This way, Miss Westwood," says a tall, reedy priestess with a light blonde braid sticking out from her hood. "Ice blonde, and in the capital, probably an Aaron. Indra Down Temple must be crawling with them." Bree glances at the priestesses sweeping or tending the altar, praying before the great black glass in the floor that they call the Goddess Stone. Their white hoods and black bracelets are supposed to strip them of their names and gifts. But Bree feels like she is walking through a nest of vipers. She follows the priestess through the temple's interior rooms, past the small open cloister, and down a set of steps into a chamber lit only by torches. "The High Priestess's rooms are not far." Bree stops. "I will wait for her here." "But just bring her to me." She shrugs out of her cloak and slings it across the back of a chair. "And tell her not to tarry." She does not look at the priestess before she goes, so she does not know whether the girl's mouth dropped open, but it probably did. Perhaps telling the High Priestess not to tarry was going a little too far. Bree considers sitting in the chair, affecting a bored pose as she waits. But the chair faces the door and the hall where Luca would approach from, and angry as she is, Bree knows that were she and Luca to stare at each other for the length of the hall, she would look away first. So instead she wanders the confines of the small, stuffy chamber, studying the fragments of ancient mosaic on the floor and the hangings on the wall, poisoner depictions of deaths by boils and a snake wreathed in poisonous flowers. There are also tapestries of familiars and battles, but they are much, much smaller.
"Bree Westwood, I am glad you have come."
Bree turns. The High Priestess stands in the doorway with a look of affection on her face, hands folded.
"Of course I came. You named me to the Black Council. Mother was thrilled. She's installed an entire household for me in the north end of the city."
"Good. And are you finding it comfortable?"
Luca steps aside as a priestess arrives carrying a tray of tea and biscuits. She sets it on the table.
"Shall I serve?" the girl asks.
"No."
Luca waves her away.
"I will serve. If you will sit, Bree."
"I will not."
She lifts her chin. It is a hard thing to refuse Luca, whom she has known and been fond of for most of her life, whom she has been taught for so long to revere.
"One pot of tea and a seat on the Black Council is not going to make everything better."
"I see.
You joined with them and ordered her execution."
Luca nods. She pours cups for them both and sweetens her own with honey.
"But she was not executed."
"No thanks to you. You would have been there when it happened. You would have stood there and watched while Queen Catherine killed her."
"I know," Luca says. "And she would have known. It is that which keeps me up at night above everything else. That she went into the sea, knowing that I abandoned her."
"Went into the sea? So you believe that she is dead?"
"A storm rose up in the mist and came for the ship."
"A storm couldn't kill Mira."
"That would depend on whose storm it was."
Bree clenches her teeth. "Of course. The goddess's storm. That is what they say came for the queens. And Luca is the goddess's most important servant, loyal only to her and to her will."
"You are such a wretched old woman."
Luca's eyes snap to hers and Bree quiets. Those eyes are not old.
You are angry, Bree.
I understand. But dead or not, Mira is gone, and we must make something of what she left behind. With we three on the council, it will be nearly as if she were the one wearing the crown.
I should oppose you, Bree says bitterly. I should do it for her.
That is not what she would want.
You do not know what she would want.
Lucas sighs. Then what do you want?
What must I do? What amends can I make?
She smiles.
Or should I pass you over for your mother?
Bree is well aware that Luca only appointed her to the Black Council as an act of contrition, and perhaps because she would be a more effective thorn in Queen Catherine's side than her mother would be, if she cooperates.
Elizabeth will stay with us, always, Bree says. The temple will make no more demands on her, and you will allow her to recall her familiar.
Priestesses do not have familiars. We do not have gifts. She made her choice.
But Luca's expression is soft. She does not really care about one tiny, tufted woodpecker.
Ro made her choose between taking her priestess vows that very moment or watching her bird be crushed. It was not really a choice. Pepper is small. She hit him before, she can do it again.
Very well.
Fine.
Bree bends and gathers her cloak.
You know why I did it, don't you, Bree? Luca asks.
Yes, I know.
She looks resentfully around at the musty old temple.
The island is what matters.
Nearly the moment that Bree exits the temple, Elizabeth grabs her and pulls her into the shadows with her one good hand, black bracelet peeking out from beneath her sleeve.
Elizabeth, I thought you were going to wait at the townhouse. What are you doing here?
Listening, the priestess replies and smiles, her cheek dimpling.
And blending in. None of these priestesses here know me enough to recognize me if I stay quiet and keep my head bowed.
She demonstrates, tucking her chin and widening her eyes until they are large and blank and simple-looking. Then she perks up.
Now, what did the High Priestess say?
Just what we expected. She wants to be friends again, so I will do what I am told.
And what did you say?
I said that I would, as long as you can stay with us and as long as you can have Pepper back. Bree grins, and Elizabeth makes a high-pitched noise and throws her arms around her neck.
Oh, Bree, thank you. But will you? Will you really do as Luca requires even after what she would have done to Mirabella?
Bree glances around, but there is no one near to hear them refer to Mirabella by name.
I may. I will for a time, at least until I find my footing in the capital. But I still intend to make every poisoner suffer, especially her.
You must be careful. She is the queen crowned, and maybe she won't be so terrible. I've heard she means to welcome you to the city with a banquet.
A banquet?
To be held later this week, in the square overlooking the harbor.
Bree looks over her friend's shoulder, toward the sea, imagining the trouble she could cause at a party held in her honor.
You are a kinder girl than I, Elizabeth, if you think her overtures are genuine.
She sighs.
Let us go back to the house.
I'll meet you there later.
Elizabeth hastily pats her shoulder and then runs off in a flurry of white robes.
First, I'm off to the woods for Pepper.
The Volroy.
Peter runs his fingers down Catherine's bare back as she lies across his chest.
Keep doing that. She whispers.
His touch is soothing, gentle. With his hands on her, she could perhaps fall asleep again,
despite the bright light streaming into her bedroom. She slept only a little the night before, unable to still her mind, no matter how Peter exhausted her body. Today is the day that Bree Westwood comes to claim her place at the table.
If I keep doing that, it will lead to more of this.
He rolls on top of her and drags kisses along her throat. What do you know about Bree Westwood? He stops kissing her and sighs.
No more than what you know. She is always fashionably dressed, certainly beautiful, never serious. She flitted about in the wake of your gloomy older sister like an idiot butterfly.
He rolls away and gets out of bed, struts across the room bare and splendid, before slipping into a dressing robe.
Perhaps someone so serious as my sister needed that lightness, Katerine says, propped up on an elbow. Perhaps I do too, and Bree will become my friend.
Or perhaps she is truly an idiot butterfly, never aware of the weight of the events transpiring around her, and now we must suffer her on the Black Council.
Peter adds wood to the dying fire and swings a pot of water over it to heat for tea. Katerine's eyes go blank, her voice empty.
Never trust her. She will always hate and resent us.
Whose words were those? Peter asks. Yours or Natalia's? Mine?
He chuckles and it sounds false.
Or someone else's?
She knows who he means. The dead queen's clamoring nervously and eagerly in her blood. The words came and went so quickly that not even Katerine is sure. Peter returns to the bed and kneels beside it. He cups her face and trails his fingertips from her neck to her collarbone.
Do you need them any more?
What do you mean?
You are the queen crowned. You have what we wanted, what they wanted. And now they can grow quiet and disappear.
Disappear. In her mind's eye, she sees Peter's neck snapping, his head twisted too far around. She can almost hear it, the crunch of bones.
Hush, hush, old sisters. I know you have had enough of disappearing.
She takes his hand and kisses it, then pushes past him to get out of bed.
I am only in the crown because of them.
She ties her dressing gown and sits at her table to rub a soothing cream into her dry, scarred hands.
It was they who brought me back, who made me strong.
I am grateful that they saved you. But it is your time to rule now, Kat. And you have always been a queen, able and blessed.
Katerine smiles at him from her reflection in the mirror. The young queen, it shows, is still pale, but not so hollow, not so sunken, and the hair falling around her in loose curls shines brightly black.
What am I without them?
Without the dead queens lending me hints of their gifts, I have nothing, no gift of my own. The dead war queens let me throw their knives. The dead poisoners let me devour their poisons. The dead naturalists make sure that new sweetheart does not turn on me and bite.
New sweetheart, he says softly.
Yes, I figured that out too. So perhaps they have even made me smarter.
You were always clever, Kat. Clever and sweet in equal measure.
He approaches from behind and squeezes her shoulders.
I will leave you to prepare.
Indeed. We do not want to be late for Bree's first day.
Katerine orders fresh pink roses to brighten the council chamber, along with plenty of cool water in silver pitchers. She has the tea cart loaded with berries and meringues and other things she has heard that elementals like to eat, and not a single drop of it is poisoned.
It is more than we could have expected, had things gone another way, Peter says when he sees her preparations.
He kisses her hand, and his teeth graze her knuckles,
sending pleasurable tingles all the way up her arm. It will be hard to revert to discretion after Peter finds her another husband. The clock ticks, and the other members of the Black Council begin to arrive. Genevieve comes to curtsy and kiss her cheek, so sweet and gentle to Catherine since the crowning. Cousin Lucien bows grandly, perhaps afraid his seat could be traded back to Cousin Allegra at any time. Renata, the priestess Romertra, and High Priestess Luca enter together and sit without a word, though Luca's old eyes twinkle like stars. Antonin sniffs at the dishes on the tea cart.
"Not a drop of poison?" he asks. "If this is how it will be, I will have to start taking a larger breakfast."
Together they wait, and wait some more. Some standing and chatting quietly, others seated and looking bored. Peter has his head propped on forefinger and thumb, staring at the untouched empty chair left specifically for Bree.
"Perhaps her carriage was delayed?" Renata suggests, and glances around meekly. "Shall we send someone out after her?" "She will be here."
Every back in the room straightens when Rose speaks. Her voice is nearly too booming for the chamber to contain.
"Her townhouse is not far. If the carriage failed, she and Elizabeth will walk."
"Elizabeth?" Genevieve asks. "Who is Elizabeth? Surely the Westwoods know that they are not allowed an entourage. Surely she has the backbone to come alone." "Of course I do," Bree Westwood calls out, her timing so perfect that Catherine wonders whether she was waiting just outside the door. The heels of her boots ring off the stone, and Catherine glimpses someone behind her, lingering in the hall in a white priestess robe. It must be the priestess Elizabeth, Mirabella's other best friend. "Perfect," Catherine whispers, and squeezes her hands tight to quiet the dead queen's grumbling as Bree Westwood blows into the Black Council like a gust of cold air. She has had weeks to prepare for this, her grand arrival, and there is nothing for Catherine to do but be gracious. Bree drops half a curtsy to Catherine, and a very full bow to High Priestess Luca, and then plops into her seat. Her chin is raised, eyes defiant, and hair cascading in bright brown waves held back by silver combs. Catherine nods to her. "Welcome to my council, Bree Westwood. I hope your journey to the capital was not difficult, and if there is anything I can do to ease the transition of your household, do not hesitate to ask." Bree does not respond, so she goes on. "I have had a special tea prepared to welcome you." She gestures toward the cart. "No, thank you," Bree says, "and please do not go to any similar trouble. I doubt if I will ever trust this council enough to eat anything that is in this room." The chamber falls silent, except for Antonin, who makes a disgusted sound. "How then are we supposed to govern together?"
"Reconciling a new council with the old is always difficult," High Priestess Luca says.
"Or so you have heard," says Ro. "The poisoners have grasped onto it for so long, who can really remember?"
For a moment, Catherine wishes she had not dismissed Margaret Boleyn, so she might see war gift against war gift and Ro's face smashed into the table. "It is so dark in here." Bree flicks her wrist, and the flames on every candelabra flare, so high that Genevieve must move a vase of pink roses so they will not scorch. "And so still, without any windows."
"There is a window."
Catherine looks upward into the shadows of the high ceiling, where windows were cut out of the stone to circulate the air, in case the doors were to be sealed.
"Well, it is so far up that it hardly matters."
Bree slips her summer wrap off her shoulders. Her dress is deep blue, embroidered with black, and very elemental, the skirt swaying with movement. The V in her bodice is so deep that Peter must be careful to keep from looking.
"If someone else," she pauses, "someone with a gift for weather were here, perhaps we could draw in a decent breeze."
Katerine notes the delicate pulse in Bree's throat. She notes the largeness of her eyes, the open V of the bodice exposing her heart like a bullseye. So many places to sink a knife. Bree Westwood is foolish indeed to speak so when the dead queens are there to hear, to see. They boil so high inside Katerine that she can almost taste their rotten flesh on the back of her tongue.
Quiet, quiet! To kill another queen is one thing. To kill a member of the council? Well, she must truly earn such a punishment.
Shall we to actual council business? Peter cocks an eyebrow. There has been unrest amongst the people concerning the bodies of the traitor queens. We keep expecting them to wash ashore, though I have heard some priestesses say it is more likely that the goddess will keep them.
He looks at Luca, whose mouth is set in a grim line. That may be true, Genevieve says, all too happy to pick up this line of conversation. Still, would it be too much to ask for the Legion-cursed naturalist to wash ashore? Or the mainland suitor? I would even settle for a few pieces of the Wolfspring boy.
I would settle for the cougar, Antonin says, and the old Black Council laughs.
That is enough,
Katerine interjects. But she cannot stop herself from smiling.
If it will put the people's minds at ease, arrange for boats and small crews to sail out of the harbor to search. Pay them well, and offer an extra reward to any who return with evidence, whole or in pieces.
She turns toward Luca and Bree.
Now, shall we plan your welcome banquet?
Bastion City. That night, Amelia takes Jules to a pub, promising that it will remind her of home, and that she could even venture to bring Camden, as the proprietors are loyal to the Vatros clan. But the moment that Jules enters, through an entrance down an alley, her hackles rise. It is less a pub than an underground room of stone with a partial dirt floor, and in the many weeks that Jules has been in Bastion, Amelia has never mentioned it. Yet she is obviously a regular, touching the shoulder of nearly everyone she passes, and nodding to the two men behind the bar.
What is this place?
We call it the Bronze Whistle, Amelia answers. Try the chicken and the wine. Stay clear of the ale, unless Berkeley pours it.
Jules glances at the bartenders. She could not guess which one was Berkeley, though both looked nice enough, sweating a little and working hard. The tall one, with the slight reddish beard, catches her watching and gives her a wink.
They have food here?
Of course. Takes a while to get it. We're underneath a manor house. They let us run through their halls and use their kitchens for a fee.
So, this is a club of sorts?
Of sorts.
Amelia leads them through the room, lit a bright gaslight yellow. It is quieter now than when they came in, as people stop to gawk and mutter about her cougar. Camden yowls happily at the smell of chicken and jumps on to a tabletop. The girls seated there shout, "Oi!" and move their mugs out of the way of her sweeping tail.
"Sorry,"
Jules mutters, and they cock their eyebrows. She coaxes Camden down and follows Amelia to a corner table, untucking the short hair behind her ears so it can swing past her face. She has not had so many eyes on her since the day in the arena at the Queen's duel.
"What will you have?" Amelia asks. "I mean, besides the chicken."
"The good ale, I suppose."
Amelia slaps her palms down on the table and turns to a server.
3 dishes of the chicken and 2 mugs of Berkeley's ale and a bowl of water for the cat.
Camden, never one to skulk on the floor, hops onto the wall bench to wait for dinner. Still, so many eyes on them, and just as many watching Jules as the cougar.
When will they stop staring?
Amelia pays the boy who brings their ale.
Maybe when you dance with them. You're a pretty girl, Jules Malone. You can't think that it was only your handsome mainlander would notice that.
Joseph wasn't a mainlander. He was one of us.
and he is still in her heart. Anyone who looks at her that way is a fool if they cannot see that Joseph's ghost sits beside her. Amelia tips her head back and forth. She has made it plain that she does not think much of Joseph, gone so long to the mainland with Billy, but she has never spoken against him. Why would she? He is dead, and it does not matter anymore. Jules tries to get comfortable in her chair and rests her elbows on the table. The air in the crowded space is close, but not stifling, the freshness aided perhaps by the kitchen's being so far away.
Oh, no, Jules groans.
What? She pushes her chin toward the door, where the oracle Mathilde sits with her eyes on them, her yellow hair braided through with a fat twist of white.
Ah, Mathilde!
Amelia waves to her. Good. Maybe I will get to hear the song of Ethiel after all. Is she really a bard? Jules asks.
Of course.
She is a seer and a bard. It is possible to be many things at once, Jules Malone. You of all people should know that. Jules frowns as the chicken arrives, but her scowl fades as she smells the steam. The chicken is stewed in a gravy and served with a thick slice of oat bread. She has to yank Camden's plate away to keep her from biting into it while it is still too hot. She blows on both dishes and twists off a small forkful, tender and delicious. Camden, tired of waiting, grabs hers with her forepaw and sloshes most of it onto the table. Then she licks her fur and burned paw pads. Amelia laughs and shakes her head. Having her around is such a danger.
Why?
I will begin to think I can treat all mountain cats this way, and I'll get 10 claws raked down my back. Jules snorts. It is not likely. Mountain cats are rare as far south as Bastion City. Camden was the only one even in the forests of Wolf Spring, as far as she knows.
Jules, look out!
The knife aimed at her is kitchen cutlery, large and sharp. She leans back as Amelia raises her hands, using her war gift to push the blade off course. Camden ducks, but not far enough, and the knife slices into her back. When her cougar winces, Jules sees red. She flips her chair and turns. It is not hard to find the one who threw the knife. The man behind the bar, the one who winked. But now his eyes are so wide, they could near fall out and hang on stalks.
You!
She shouts. Her war gift surges unbidden and sends him flying against the wall. Bottles and glasses fall to the floor and shatter. Camden, who was not badly hurt, leaps across the tables and onto the bar, snarling and swiping with her good paw, the cut on her back spattering blood into spilled beer.
Stop! Amelia calls. Berkeley, you idiot! You were supposed to wait until she'd finished eating. And you were not to harm the cat. Was you who harmed the cat? You pushed the knife into her path.
Berkeley gets to his feet and brushes at his trousers. He curses when his fingers come away bloody.
I just mended these.
Jules turns to Amelia.
You knew? This was planned?
They needed to see your gift.
Don't get angry. You lack control. I'll give you control, Jules growls, and every glass on the bar begins to shake.
No one reacts. Perhaps because they are in the city of the war gifted. But then the murmurs begin, and Jules goes cold, and Camden creeps off the bar to curl around her legs. Near the door, on the far side of the room, the oracle Mathilde rises to her feet.
It is as I said. Jeanne Malone was once a queen, and she may yet be a queen again.
Jules moans.
Don't go spreading that nonsense around.
But in the bronze whistle at least, it is too late, and now she knows why they have stared at her since she came in.
Amelia, who are these people?
Amelia grins. We are the Queen's Revolt. And you, Jules, a gifted naturalist, also gifted in war, will be the one to unite us and take the poisoner's place. She grabs Amelia by the sleeve. How long have you been planning this? The seers have known of your coming for a long time. The seers are fools. They said I should be drowned at birth. Now they say I'm a queen, or I will be, or I was once already. But Jules's words cast no doubt across the faces in the whistle. They are too full of hope. In her, they see a chance they have not had in generations. And Jules has heard that there is nothing a warrior loves more than to run into a battle headlong with little chance of victory. That is where the glory is, they say. That is where heroes are made. Jules has never heard anything quite so stupid. Prophecy has many interpretations, says Mathilde, as she crosses the room to stand before them. Unfortunately, it is often difficult to know the meaning until after it has come to pass. But it says I was once a queen. I was never. In another life, perhaps, Mathilde replies. Or a less literal interpretation. Like when she was briefly queen by using her gift to impersonate Arsinoe's hold over the bear during the quickening ceremony? Of course, Jules does not mention that. The flames of this madness have been fanned enough already.
The prophecies were clearer once, Berkeley pipes up, avoiding Jules's eyes. Before the bleeding Black Council started drowning all the Oracle Queens.
Bitter mutters of agreement ripple through the room. It does not matter that it was an ancient council who passed that decree, or that the same council may have been populated by those with the war gift. The words Black Council have become synonymous with the poisoners, and poisoners are easy to blame. I'm not, Jules starts, and then louder.
I'm not your leader. I can't be. I'm Legion cursed, and it's called a curse for a reason.
For a foolish reason. You have not gone mad.
Amelia tugs Jules closer.
What did you think you were here for? That enough time would pass and we would move you upstairs with a patch to hide your green eye? That we would say you're a cousin and Camden a pet cow?
I don't know what I thought.
Jules's heart pounds as she looks into the faces at the bronze whistle. The expectations there, the belief. Amelia touches Jules's hair and gently tucks it behind her ear.
I know you are broken-hearted. I know you lost Queen Arsinoe and that boy, and you feel like you are nothing without them. But you are wrong. Even if you are right, your destiny will find you anyway. Already our whisperers tell us the people have no faith in the poisoner, and the Aarons fight amongst themselves as if tugging on Natalia Aaron's bones. By the time we storm the gates of the Volroy, we will have spread tale of you, our Legion Queen. Across the entire island. The people will scream your name, and we will take Catarine in chains.
Indrid Down. Catarine oversees the setup for the welcome banquet herself. It must all be perfect. The food, the flowers, the music, and insofar as she can manage it, the company. We should have held this indoors, Genevieve grumbles. At the Highburn, like Lucian and I suggested. These clouds. What if it rains?
Then the elementals will enjoy it all the more, Peter replies.
He directs a servant as to where to place the chairs and which arrangements of flowers should go on the head table.
And stop scowling, Genevieve. People are watching.
Catarine glances up and sees the curious faces half-hidden behind shutters and curtains. She squeezes her scarred wrists and knuckles through her light summer gloves. They ache today, as they have not ached in a long time, as they sometimes do when the dead queens are dormant. She calls for a glass of water, and as she waits, touches the healed black band of ink across her forehead, her permanent crown, tattooed in the old fashion. Peter leans close to whisper,
"It will be all right, Cat. You are doing the right thing. You must not let the likes of Bree Westwood get to you."
"It is not truly her that we have to worry about." Genevieve takes the water from the servant and brings it to the queen. It is the High Priestess. Luca is shrewd, appointing herself to the council, choosing the Westwood daughter just to make trouble.
"If Natalia were alive," Peter mutters, "she would never have dared."
Katerine raises her chin. "It was Luca herself who administered the crown. Needles upon needles sinking into my skin. She cannot want to unseat that which she so recently bestowed. She only wants to crow and see if she can drown us out."
"She wants to see how far she can push you," says Peter.
"But I suppose," Genevieve sighs, "that is how it always is after an ascension, after any new appointment to the council. If we stand our ground, eventually she will give up." "Queen Katerine?" A servant, hair covered in baking flour, approaches quickly and takes a knee.
"Pardon the interruption, my queen."
"Of course. Speak."
"The feast is prepared, and I was told to tell you, to inform you, that the High Priestess is on her way. I don't know why they sent a servant from the kitchens. We're all just very busy, and..."
Katerine touches the man's head. "It is all right. Once the feast is in place, take your ease. Eat." She looks up at the building before her and gestures to the faces ducked behind the windows. "All are welcome. As many as the square can hold." She steps onto the raised platform and stands before the head table, rubbing flour from the palm of her glove. Genevieve and Peter hurry away to see to last touches. The last of the pale ribbon hung from the lamps, the final sprays of pink and purple flowers. Her black council waits at the edges of the square and greets the first folk who wander in. Not something they are terribly accustomed to, and the strained expressions of pleasantness stretched across Lucian's and Antonin's faces make Katerine chuckle. Before long, the tables are full, and so many people stand between that it is hard for the High Priestess, Roe, and Bree Westwood to make their way through when they arrive in their carriage. In any case, it seems they are in no great hurry to reach the head table. Luca stops to offer blessing to every person she passes. Even Roe tries to woo the guests, though some will not come close enough for a handshake, and she is near unrecognizable when smiling. Luckily for her, Bree can charm enough for the both of them. She is more beautiful than ever, with her hair studded with opals, and her bright green summer gown highlights the fact that Katerine may wear only black. "Wait." Katerine stops a servant as she passes with a tureen of soup. She dips a spoon and tastes it. "The little brat had better eat something today. This soup is too good to miss." The banquet progresses, as banquets do, until someone notices a commotion near the harbor. Katerine has almost relaxed enough to sample the desserts when cries of alarm begin to rise. Peter nods to one of the queen's guard, and several soldiers push through the crowd. Everyone has turned toward Barden Harbor, even the guards.
"Peter, what is it?"
Catherine asks and stands. The mist has risen thick over the water, so thick it might be a cloud, if clouds were known to creep quickly and deliberately toward land. At the sight of it coming closer, those nearest the docks start to back up, and then to flee, walking quickly up the hill for higher ground. Katerine glances nervously around the square. There are so many people gathered. If they are not careful, there will be a panic. She thrusts out her arm and snaps her fingers at High Priestess Luca.
"You and I must go there now."
She walks around the table and Luca is already out of her chair following.
Bring horses for me and the High Priestess, she says loudly, and clear a path to the harbor.
Make way for the queen. Stand clear.
In moments, her queen's guard has opened the road to them. Katarine's black stallion is ready for her, always nearby and saddled in case of emergency. She half leaps and is half thrown onto his back.
That was good work, Luca says, when she is mounted and riding beside her. Nothing curbs a panic like the courage of a queen. Natalia would be proud.
I am too distracted just now to wonder whether you mean that, Katarine replies. Her eyes are ahead, on the approaching mist. She hears, behind them in the square, Peter and the Black Council mounting horses to follow. As they ride to the docks, she holds her stallion to a canter to keep from trampling anyone near the shore, but she need not have bothered. Her figure on horseback is enough to clear a path, hair a black flag and black gown billowing, and the gathered folk part like butter to a hot blade.
Stay. Do not dismount.
Luca holds her hand out across Katarine's reins.
The mist does not do this. I do not know what it means.
I am the queen crowned.
Katarine takes a breath and swings her leg over to land on the dirt.
I have nothing to fear. It is my mist.
Hers. Theirs. The mist has been the protector of the island ever since it was created by the last and greatest Blue Queen. It will not hurt her. It cannot. It was her bloodline that made it.
Help me, old sisters.
She reaches out to them with her mind and feels their familiar surge in her veins. Katarine walks toward the shore as the dead queens fill her ears with shrieks. She walks until the sand is wet from the surf, and then they allow her to go no farther. A wall of white and swirling gray stretches across the harbor from north to south. It has traveled into the shallows, closer than she has ever seen it, and continues to advance, moving like the sea creatures do, smoothly and swiftly. The way it darts at times reminds her of a striking shark. How badly Katarine wants to run. The mist is so thick. If it rushes upon the shore, she is sure it will knock her down and smother her, choke her. She will die and find the ghosts of Mirabella and Arsinoe waiting inside the gloom.
No,
she whispers.
You must stop.
The mist pushes forward, and the people behind her scream. Perhaps even the High Priestess, certainly Genevieve. But before the cloud can touch the earth, it draws back and moves away. Back out to sea to dissipate and break apart. Gone so quickly, it is hard to believe it was there in the first place. Katarine hears footsteps as Ro comes to stand at her shoulder, along with Peter, backed by a dozen queen's guard.
Queen Katarine, are you unharmed?
He examines her, but she pats his hand and moves him aside. She was not touched.
What is that?
Ro draws her serrated knife and points into the waves. Something dark and heavy rolls through the water. A dark shape, soon joined by more, cresting and coming toward shore. Screams and moans of terror sound from all sides as Katarine walks toward the water to see what the mist has brought.
Keep them quiet, she orders. Keep them back.
The dead sisters hiss and spit. They scratch at her insides and retreat to the darkest corners of her mind. She does not care. Nor does she care when she steps into the water up to the ankles and catches waves across her knees. The mist has brought her bodies. Ragged, waterlogged corpses tossed heavily into the shallows. Katarine splashes in deeper. The goddess has answered her prayer. She has brought her the corpses of her sisters and the cursed naturalist, the mainland suitor, and the wolf spring boy.
Her hope to see what is left of Mirabella and Arsinoe is so strong that she convinces herself it is them. Even though there are far too many, far more than she sought. She convinces herself it is them until she turns the first one over and sees a stranger's watery eyes staring back. As the bodies beach themselves, Katarine searches up and down the sand, looking into one dead face and then another for some spark of recognition. But none are queens.
Haul them out!
She points to the water. She shouts when her queen's guard hesitates to move.
Haul them out and line them up on the sand!
It takes several minutes for the task to be completed. Her soldiers grimace, and some will not touch the corpses or enter the water until Ro forces them to at knife point.
My priestesses are braver than you,
Ro barks, and several priestesses hurry into the surf to help, wetting their white robes to the waist. Katarine and Ro survey the bodies lined up on the beach. Pieces of their crafts have been brought up as well, bits of curved hull and planks, an oar. Some on shore and others still bobbing in the waves, scattered tidbits.
What is this?
Katarine asks, and no one replies.
Bring me someone who might know.
Rose shouts to the gathered crowd, and a man comes forward, wringing his hat between his hands. In the face of so much death, he almost forgets to drop to his knee.
You are familiar with the harbor?
I am, my queen.
Can you tell me, then, who these people are?
They are...
He hesitates, looks up and over the wet shapes laid out.
They are the searchers. They sailed this morning at your request to search for the remains of the traitor queens.
Katarine clenches her jaw.
Is this all of them?
I don't know, my queen. It seems so.
He presses his handkerchief to his sweating, balding head, and then again to his mouth and nose. The stench of rotting flesh is thick in the heat.
But if they sailed that morning, they should not smell at all.
Katarine dismisses the man and steps closer to the corpses with Ro.
All sailed out today, he said, Ro says in a low voice. But some of these bodies are much older, as if
they drowned weeks ago.
Katarine stares down the line of wet, bloated dead. Some large, some small, some missing parts. Women and men alike. Fishers and sailors who were doing her bidding. They had hoped to find Arsinoe and Mirabella face down in the sea and net themselves a fine reward. Now they remind Katarine of seals spread out to lounge on the warm sand. The bravest of the gulls flaps down atop one of the farthest bodies and begins to tear at it like a thief after coin. Then it raises its head and flies away. Someone with the naturalist gift must have told it to wait.
What could have done all this?
Peter turns to the balding man.
Did they all sail together, travel as a fleet?
No, Master Aaron. The Caraway sisters and their brother,
he gestures to three.
They set out in two small craft with crew.
He points to several more.
Mary Howe and her crew there. She has the elemental gift and a knack for storms. She's never once sailed into bad weather, that one.
Mary Howe lies face up and freshly dead, her blue shirt buttoned to the throat. What she wore on her bottom half is anyone's guess. The entirety of her lower body is gone, torn away. Katarine walks to her and leans down, pushing up her shirt tails, and lifts the torso to better look at the wound. It is ragged, and there are errant tooth marks. A shark. The rest of the body is pristine.
Odd for the shark to leave it so. Odd for a shark to have killed her at all in these waters.
the bodies lying on the beach tell a strange story. Some are clearly drowned, with purple lips and bloated faces, while others bear signs of harm. A boy, with one side of his head cleaved in, as if from a heavy, sharp object. Another, with what looks to be a stab wound to the heart. Some bodies seem to have been dead so long that the flesh falls from them in whitened, waterlogged chunks. Yet others, like Mary Howe's, are so fresh she might have died only hours ago. Katerine kneels and buries her gloved hands deep in the rot of some poor girl, her face unrecognizable.
Queen Katerine, Peter says.
What? She moves to the next body, and the next, turning their heads left and right, inspecting them. They are a message, she thinks. They have something to tell her, if she will only look hard enough. How? How did you die? She murmurs, and Peter puts his hand on her shoulder.
Cat.
She stops and looks up, sees all the gathered, staring faces. They have watched her pick through the bodies crouched like a crab, her black silk gloves slicked with blood to the elbows. Reluctantly, Katerine rises. I am a poisoner, Peter, taught by Natalia these many years. What do they think? That I am shy to what death does to flesh? That I have never seen a gut burst open? Peter's mouth draws into a firm line. Even he, and Aaron himself, looks slightly green. Katerine stares out toward the sea. Clear now, calm and shining on a sunny afternoon. Gathered higher on the beach, the people whisper. Too many whispers and voices to identify. But she is able to hear one word, above all. Undead. The Mainland. At first, when Mirabella hears Arsinoe muttering in her sleep, she thinks she must be having some scandalous dream about Billy. Mirabella has stayed awake, lying in the dark and listening to Arsinoe's breathing slow, listening to her drift off, looking after her, as an older sister should after a younger sister is frightened in a graveyard. So when she hears Arsinoe start to murmur happily, she smiles, torn between listening closer and pressing her pillow around her ears. She is reaching for her pillow when Arsinoe says, Sentra. Mirabella sits up and turns toward her sister. She knows that word. She listens closer as the dream goes on, Arsinoe muttering faster and faster, her words becoming harder to hear. Sometimes it is only a snort. Lots of snorts, actually. And Mirabella bites her lip to keep from laughing. Suddenly, after a moment of quiet, Arsinoe jolts up from her pillow, back straight as a board. Then she slumps and rubs her face with both hands. What a dream, she whispers. Arsinoe? She flinches when Mirabella says her name. What was that? It was... Why are you awake? Did I wake you? I was not asleep. Their room is so dark that Arsinoe is only shapes. Hints of bare arms poking out of her pale night clothes. Mirabella climbs out from underneath her sheets and goes to sit at the foot of Arsinoe's bed. She takes the candle from her bedside table. Her fire feels close. She can almost sense the heat of it, curling around her ankles like a warm and loyal pet. A small pet, now, after weeks on the mainland. Mirabella stares at the wick of the candle and calls the flame. Nothing happens. It is so slow and shy. Each time it takes longer and longer, and the muscle inside her mind goes slack. You can always use a match, Arsinoe says. Elementals with gifts of fire do not use matches. But she sets the candle down. What were you dreaming about? Nothing. Are you keeping secrets? No.
I'm just not sure I'm ready to tell you I'm losing my mind.
Mirabella touches the tip of the wick. It is not even warm, and shame creeps up the back of her neck.
You said Sentra. Is that what you were dreaming of?
You know it, Arsinoe says, and then, of course you do. So what do you know about it?
Not much.
Most people on the island wouldn't even recognize the name.
Mirabella thinks back to her teachings, to afternoons with Luca in the temple, surrounded by stacks of books, even all the way back to Willa and the Black Cottage. I know that Sentra is the name of Fenburn's ally to the north, before the mist came. That is all.
That's all?
What else mattered? All nations that are not Fenburn are the mainland now.
Do you know anything about their history? Arsinoe asks.
Nothing, she replies.
Think hard. Nothing about a missing Fenburn queen called Daphne?
A missing Fenburn queen? Of course not.
Arsinoe, what are you dreaming of?
What about Henry Redvale?
Arsinoe.
She turns to her in the dark to demand answers, but that name, Henry Redvale.
Redvale of Sentra, she says.
I think he was Queen Ilion's king consort. Queen Ilion, the last blue queen.
Queen Ilion.
Yes, Mirabella says.
She would say more, but everyone knows of Ilion, the last and greatest blue queen, who won a great war with the mainland, and whose gift was so strong that she created the very mist that shrouds and protects them to this day. Everyone knows that legend, even those who resist study as hard as Arsinoe.
Arsinoe gets out of bed and starts to pace, jostling the little dog at the foot of the bed that Mirabella had nearly forgotten about.
Her king consort? But he loves Daphne. And if Daphne is nowhere in the history books, then did she stay behind or go back to the island to be killed? And if Henry Redvale was a real person, then I really am...
She stops and turns back to Mirabella in the dark.
Dreaming through her eyes.
Dreaming through whose eyes?
Daphne's.
Daphne? Mirabella says doubtfully.
The lost Fenburn queen?
Arsinoe quiets, and Mirabella finally strikes a match to light the candle, tired of trying to decipher her sister's expressions in the blackness. Yellow-orange light flickers through the room. She touches her candle to the lamp on Arsinoe's bedside table, and the space glows brighter. Arsinoe's eyes are haunted. But even so, the corner of her mouth is upturned, as though she is amused.
Tell me what you dreamed.
I dreamed I was inside someone else.
Arsinoe touches the ends of her hair, down past her shoulder now. She touches her chest and her face, as if to make sure they are still hers.
Someone who sailed ships on Sentra with Henry Redvale and had black eyes and hair, just like ours.
On Sentra, Mirabella says.
With Henry Redvale.
Arsinoe, that was over 400 years ago.
400?
She sits down beside Mirabella on the bed, pulling the dog into her arms when he wakes and begins to whine.
What does that mean?
Why am I dreaming it?
It cannot be real. It must not be. Perhaps it is only a memory, from a book you forgot about reading.
Maybe, Arsinoe whispers, but Mirabella can tell she does not think so. Except, I saw something else, first, in the cemetery.
What?
Mirabella holds her breath. Finally, her sister is ready to tell her what happened. She has been patient, but her patience has started to wear thin.
A dark figure, like a shadow.
She had on a crown made of silver and bright blue stones.
Arsinoe goes to her desk and rifles through it for paper and ink.
The sound of the pen scratching across it in the dark sends unpleasant twitches down Mirabella's spine. She hands the paper to Mirabella, who looks at it in the candlelight. The Blue Queen's crown.